Support also comes from Bethke Heating and Air Conditioning, installing Mitsubishi electric ductless air conditioners, an option for old homes and newly remodeled spaces. Mitsubishi, dedicated to offering cooling that is quiet and energy efficient. BethkeHeating.com.
The Federal Reserve wrapped up its two-day policy meeting yesterday, and it was watched like a hawk by investors and policymakers looking for clues as to whether the Fed would raise interest rates more quickly than previously conveyed through its nuanced speak. The Fed, in the end, held interest rates steady and expressed confidence that a recent rise in inflation to near the U.S. central bank's target would be sustained. So why does the Fed matter so much to us? What is the Fed's connection to central banks around the world? It's questions we're putting to a former Wall Street executive joining us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nomi Prinz was previously managing editor at Goldman Sachs, ran the International Analytics Group as a senior managing director at Bear Stearns in London. She's written four magazines, authored six books. Her latest out this week, it's called Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Nomi, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Well, you break up your book into major case studies: Japan, China, Europe, Brazil, Mexico, and we'll get to all of those later on. But let's first talk about what a central bank is. And we're most familiar with the Federal Reserve, but tell us how central banks function and how the Federal Reserve fits into that.
The main function, the day job of central banks, is to ensure that the banking system and financial system is adequately running. In other words, it's supposed to regulate that system. When there is an emergency situation, it's to provide lending of last resort. That's not what happened over the past decade. It's been the lender to regular private banks of all resorts. And in the case of the Fed, for example, and other major central banks today, as you mentioned, there's a target level of inflation, which at the moment is set around 2%. And there's a desire to have what they consider to be full employment, as measured by actually a lot of old statistics of employment, but to balance that. And they do that by setting the level of interest rates that the Fed or these central banks provide the private banking system, and that then goes out through the rest of the world. So they're able at these policy meetings to decide to raise or lower rates depending on whether they think they need to provide money more cheaply to the banking system and therefore onto the rest of the financial system, or to tighten it and create it in a more expensive atmosphere.
And so central banks are all watching each other to figure out what the other will do and then react accordingly?
Well, that's on the surface. The reality is, and as I researched and talk about in my book Collusion, is that in the wake of the financial crisis of 2008, when the private banks in the U.S. had basically caused the crisis, not even basically, but actually caused the crisis, there was some partnerships and codependencies with other major private banks in the rest of the world. But for the most part, it was an engineering disaster by the U.S. financial system and the major private banks emanating from Wall Street and also California in the form of Wells Fargo. And what that did was catalyze the Fed to basically cut rates to zero to create or conjure a lot of money. It's called money supply in sort of Federal Reserve speak, but a supply of money into the system electronically. And the idea was that it would sort of solidify what the banks had done to the financial system, and that it would also be an emergency measure. And so it wasn't so much that other central banks around the world were watching for what the Fed was doing and wondering. The Fed required, and that's kind of why I use the term collusion, it required the cooperation of, in particular, the major central banks in the world, like the European Central Bank, the ECB in Europe, the Bank of Japan in Japan, to go along with this policy of reducing the cost of money to banks to zero, as it has been almost for the last decade, and to start producing or conjuring electronic money with which to buy assets or securities from banks. It became from markets, from corporates, from the stock market, depending on the country, over this past 10-year period, to the tune of what is now a $21 trillion tab across all the major central banks, but $4.5 trillion on reserve at the Federal Reserve Bank here.
So then where does quantitative easing come into this conversation? And this role that you write about dark money, how does that factor in?
So quantitative easing is an unnecessarily elaborate term for conjuring money and using it to buy things out of the market, basically through the banks, in order to give them that money, but not effectively just throw it out, kind of use it to buy something in return. So what the Federal Reserve did in terms of three quantitative easing programs, QE1, QE2, and QE3, over the years since the financial crisis, is they created money, and they used it to both buy treasury bonds and mortgage bonds from the banks. Because the way our financial system works is bonds are created, government bonds, by our Treasury Department. They are provided to the major private banks. They're called private or primary dealers. And then those banks sell it to anyone else, to investors, to the central bank in China, the central bank in Japan, and so forth. And what quantitative easing did was it allowed the Fed to buy those securities back from the banks that they had just received from the Treasury Department and provide them, as was part of the Emergency Act that was passed in the wake of the crisis, a quarter of a point interest. So it allowed the banks to receive the money, to give the Fed back bonds that they had anyway, and to receive interest on those bonds in the meantime. And that process is still going, and that is $2.5 trillion worth of U.S. Treasury bonds. To the top of that, the Fed at the time bought about $1.5 trillion of mortgage bonds. So if we recall that toxic assets was the phrase that was given to mortgage securities that were basically valued or rated highly by rating agencies, which get paid by the private banks and before going into the financial crisis, and that's what caused the crisis. People and institutions and entities bought things that didn't have the value that banks said they did, and they also were lent money by these banks to buy more of them, and that caused a bigger crisis ultimately. The Fed decided to buy $1.5 trillion of those from the banks at the time. What that allowed as part of that quantitative easing program was banks to overvalue the mortgage assets they had remaining on their books, receive extra money that they needed in a jam, and continue to basically artificially overvalue everything since then by virtue of the fact that the Fed was this sort of buyer of their securities. And again, this process was something that was global. Mm. And so that's where that $21 trillion comes from and the collusion comes from.
Well, Nomi, shouldn't we have learned something since the Great Recession? I mean, you're talking here about the toxic assets. And in 2012, we learned of the fixed LIBOR rates. Some of the world's leading banks kept their own borrowing costs super cheap. What happened in the UK that rippled into other areas of finance?
Right, so LIBOR, or the acronym for the London Interbank Offering Rate, is the rate that banks use to lend to each other. So there's like this cascade of money, right? So it comes from the central banks at a very low level, the cost of money. So for the Fed, it's the federal funds rate, and that goes into banks, and then they lend to each other at a slightly higher level. And so what they did going into the crisis, because what they wanted is to have the cheapest way to create the most amount of assets that were pegged or that were priced relative to this LIBOR rate. And so by rigging the LIBOR rate, by getting together and saying, look, if we make the cost of the borrowing to each other, and this was before the financial crisis, more cheap, then we can create more of these securities. We can make more money because we're basically lending to each other cheaply, and we can then create more securities on the back of this money that we now have, or purchase them or trade them. And that's going to allow us to make more money when we sell them because we've basically gotten them more cheaply. And so they got together and rigged, and that was a felony. And ultimately, a number of banks, including in the U.S. and in Europe, were slapped with fines for doing that. And the reality is they're still doing that now, down, but in a different way on the way up. They're basically trying to do other things with LIBOR now, but that's going to probably come out in the wake of our next crisis, because nothing has really fundamentally, and to your point, have we learned anything? I think the public has learned some stuff, but it seems like from a regulation perspective or a central bank role, which is supposed to also include regulation perspective, or a political role, which is supposed to include legislation that protects us from these sorts of rigs, we haven't learned, or they haven't learned very much.
Yeah, you wrote just last week that you see shadows of 2008 emerging right now, but we're getting a sense of optimism about the economy. It's coming from the Trump administration. It's coming from, we've heard the word optimistic being used around the Federal Reserve. But what are you seeing that perhaps is different from what maybe Americans are hearing about the economy and these really low unemployment rates? It seems like the economy is humming right along.
Well, when you look at generic terms, they're very different from, I think, what people experience in their own personal economies anyway. And so breaking that down, one of the indicators that the Trump administration, and frankly the Obama administration before that, but Trump's just sort of more exuberant about the language, is that the stock market's been so high. Now recently, it's had a lot of wobbles in the last couple of months. And one of the reasons for that is this uncertainty with respect to what the Fed was going to do under the newly appointed chair of the Fed, Jerome Powell, by President Trump. And also the fact that these signs are coming into play, which were also coming into play in 2008, which is that there's a lot of debt in the market. At the time, we were focused more on mortgage debt. Now it's corporate debt, and it's corporate debt internationally, because over the last 10 years, with the cheap level of rates, with the money that was made available by the Federal Reserve and other major central banks, private banks did two things. They worked with major corporations on deals that created more debt for those corporations, and those corporations used that debt to buy their own stock. The banks themselves bought more of their own stock because all they had to do was ask the Fed, in our country and in other countries, other central banks, whether they could use some of their reserve money, their money that's supposed to be put aside for emergencies or lending to real people or small businesses or whatever, into buying their own stock, which had the benefit for them of pushing up the stock market. So mm-hmm. The stock market has been artificially inflated by the source of money, which is the central banks. The private banks, which have been able to use it to buy their own stock and to work with other companies to borrow money to buy their own stock. So all of that has created, and in different ways, in the developed countries and in the emerging countries, this massive amount of debt. And that debt is now equivalent to between 2 and 3 times global GDP. So we're operating on this system in which growth is predicated on debt. And so if the cost of debt, if rates go up even a little bit, starting from the Federal Reserve, as they started to do at the end of 2015, well, then the cost of that debt for everyone, for companies, for countries, for individuals, starts to go up. And when it starts to go up, if companies are already not making real profits, it's just their stocks look good because of these buybacks, well, then they don't have anything to repay the debt that they borrowed in order to buy their own stock and to do other things. And so that starts to create this cascade inward from the cascade upward. And that's what we're seeing now. We're seeing defaults starting to kick in. We're seeing consumer debt or household debt, as per the Fed's own statistics, at record highs. We're seeing that the amount of money that a paycheck provides versus the cost of real life, not sort of average costs of prices that indicate inflation, but real life, is actually higher than wage increase has been. And so people are living on the edge. Companies, many of them, particularly small and medium ones, are living on the edge. And so any uncertainty, any defaults, any payments that don't get made in one part of that ladder start to hurt everyone else. And that's sort of what happened in the financial crisis. Difference now is that we're operating from a higher level of debt everywhere.
And Nomi, coming out of the financial crisis, one of the takeaways was we got to break up these big banks. Did we successfully do that?
We broke up no banks. What happened was, to an extent, the big banks bought up some of the smaller and medium-sized banks along the way because they had all this excess money with which to do that, among other things that they were doing. The larger banks in the country, the big six banks collectively, have about 40% more deposits and about 84% more assets than they did before the financial crisis, give or take a few percentages. So they've basically grown. They have had to pay fines along the way. The top six banks have paid about $110 billion and counting.
Wait, $110 billion in fines?
Just for the top six banks. That's Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley, which we just sort of call the big six banks, have collectively done that. And it's counting. And Wells Fargo, for example, just a couple weeks ago was slapped with a $1 billion settlement because they decided to defraud some of their customers in the field of mortgage and auto loans. So, the stuff continues to repeat. But again, they're bigger than they were before. They really benefited so much from the financial crisis relative to ordinary people, and a lot of that was because their connection to access to cheap money and the policy of cheap money and quantitative easing from the Fed and sort of this extends throughout the world with other central banks has been very, very giving. It's been very, very much a subsidy to these big banks. And they, for example, this quarter, their CEOs have received, as we now know, somewhere between 15 to 40% extra compensation over just last year, including the head Tim Sloan of Wells Fargo, who got a 37% bump in his compensation while his bank was basically stealing from its customers. When someone steals a car, it's a felony. When a bank like Wells Fargo, who's benefited, among others, from all this largesse from the central bank, has been able to take money from customers, which has disabled them from being able to pay for their cars and caused 27,000 cars to be repossessed, that should be 27,000 felonies. But it's not. It's none. It's a settlement.
We're talking about the lessons learned from the financial crisis a decade ago, pulling back the veil on how central banks operate today. Nomi Prin stays with us on the morning show. Her new book is Collusion, How Central Banks Rigged the World. You can join in the conversation with your questions, your observations, 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the Fed or how it works with other financial institutions? How do you see the connection between your circumstances and decisions made on a global financial stage? You can call in, you can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. So would less autonomous central banks, having less power to wield over the world economic order, would that be a good thing? It's a question we're mulling here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. If central bankers did not have that independence, would their judgments have been better in the financial crisis of 2007 to 2008? And so what does the jockeying of central banks mean today for individual pocketbooks here in Wisconsin? We're looking broad scale. We're going granular with Nomi Prins. She's a former Wall Street executive, and she's out with a sharp critique of the dominance of central banks around the globe. The book is Collusion. Your questions, your insights are welcome at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the economic path we're on, or are the U.S. and other countries positioned for success? Do you struggle to see how central banks are relevant to your own life, to your circumstances? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Rick in Park Falls has been waiting a while. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Good morning. Like so many of these major financial catastrophes, we've had a real severe wake-up call in the United States before this happened. In 1999, President Clinton had met personally with President Putin of Russia, and President Clinton had a very favorable impression that President Putin was a very honest man that could be relied upon. Of course, this is all bunkum. But as a result of that, President Clinton approved an IMF bailout of the Russian banking system in 1999 of $22.6 billion. And a lot of that money got siphoned off for corrupt purposes, including a major scandal with an outfit called Three Whales, which is a big department store in Russia that was involved in money laundering and gun running and God only knows what. And it was connected to the Bank of New York, and there was a big FBI investigation of the Bank of New York as a result of this crisis. But obviously we didn't learn anything there, because in the waning days of the Clinton administration, they not only eliminated the Glass-Steagall Law, which was voted for in the Depression to separate commercial banking from investment banking, because that was regarded as one of the causes of the Great Depression. The Clintons eliminated that law. And not only that, the Clintons allowed special treatment to these big Wall Street banks that had been big contributors to the Democrat Party national campaigns.
And Rick,
what I
want to...
That is that they changed the reserve requirements to 1 in 33, which is very, very irresponsible.
And Rick, I want to pause you right there, because that's a lot to chew on. First, the IMF, and then the Glass-Steagall Act. Nomi, can you take those apart? Unpack that.
Sure, Rick, and that's really just excellent analysis. Yes, there is a relationship between the IMF, which is sort of the sort of composite of a lot of the central banks and makes policies to an extent and has involvement with all of the central banks. And so there's a collusion element on that as well. And I talk about the IMF actually throughout the chapters. I go regionally, but they're sort of present in a lot of manners, as is the Federal Reserve. I don't even have a separate chapter for the Federal Reserve because it's sort of omnipresent. And you're right, in the wake of a lot of pressure from Wall Street in 1999, the Glass-Steagall Act, which had been in place since the Great Depression in 1933, was repealed. And it was repealed by a overwhelmingly bipartisan vote. So the relationship between the major Wall Street banks at the time, and still is, and was before that, was quite close. And the pressure was from these banks to reduce their restrictions on the types of businesses in which they could engage and to use people's deposits. You know, Kate, going back to your comments about where people come into all of this, use individual deposits and individual loans as sort of collateral for all of these other larger lending situations, for government lending, sort of development type initiatives, but more from a political standpoint than actual development, and also to create this major wave of speculation in the financial system. Look, if someone gives anyone a ton of money that they don't have to effectively pay back and says you can go to sort of any part of any Vegas casino and you can play it and you can see if you win. If you win, that's great. You keep the winnings. If you lose, we'll give you more money to keep going. And by the way, we'll insure it. Then that's a win for that person. That's a win for the banks that effectively are in this situation. That's what repealing the Glass-Steagall Act of 1999 enabled. I was actually in London at the time, and the argument from Robert Rubin, who was the president of Goldman Sachs and went on from that position to be the Treasury Secretary of Clinton and was one of the major pushers of the repeal, and he wasn't there at the time. He left to be a vice chair on the board of Citigroup, which benefited from the Glass-Steagall repeal. But, you know, the policy was pushed to deregulate our banking system, which ultimately led to the financial crisis of 2008, was pushed on both sides, and it was pushed by banks. It was pushed by bankers who were in the positions of economic advisors or treasury secretaries, and it was very and remains very bipartisan. And so the problem with that is that it means we don't learn things from a policy perspective in terms of what crises look like and why they happen. And we're still in the position where these banks are able, and this is why Wells Fargo could steal all this money from their clients, they're able to provide insurance, they're able to create derivatives, they're able to use deposits and loans as collateral for other activities, they're able to receive money now cheaply in the last 10 years, they're able to use it to buy their stocks and take a little off the side to pay the settlements for the crimes they've committed, and they remain largely unreformed and unrestructured, and this is kind of part of the overall problem. It's more a problem in the United States because our banks tend to be drivers of the more speculative types of financial sort of endeavors in the world, and we, our banks, were the ones that caused the financial crisis for the most part, and still remain least reformed from that time.
Nomi, I think this is a really good opportunity to talk about how you begin your book, because just a few pages from the cover, you have a list of people you call characters, the conjurers of money. And it's important, I think, to get back to this idea that relationships and people are behind and driving a lot of these decisions at the end of the day about how the currencies work, how the financial instruments work around the world. So why did you start your book with this list of characters?
Well, first of all, it's very hard to keep track of them because, you know, we're in the United States, other people are in their areas, and we sort of, if we're even paying attention, hear about the main characters, the main, you know, heads of central banks, the conjurers, the treasury secretaries in our country, the ministers of finance in other countries. And there's just a lot of names. And there's also the names of the people who were running the governments at the time when certain policies were enacted that were enablers as well, even though these central banks are theoretically, or at least in our country and in Europe and somewhat in Japan, supposed to be independent from their governments and actually make a big deal out of being independent. The reality is they're independent when they want to be and they're not independent when they don't want to be. And so this sort of elite combination of people and relationships really proliferates the entire system and the source of money at that system, which is the central banks. And so I kept the characters there in a way. And I also divided the book into regions because each region and each chapter goes back to the financial crisis and moves forward to today. So I go into Mexico, I start in 2008, I go forward to today, China, back to 2008, forward to today. I kind of looked at it as a Quentin Tarantino film, you know, you're just going to go back to the same scene, and you're like, okay, let's look at this scene from another perspective. And so the main character is the Federal Reserve from an entity perspective, but it was Ben Bernanke when he was the chair, it was Janet Yellen when she was the chair. I got into a teeny smidge of Jerome Powell because I had to hand the book in, and so I think that's more in sort of after copy. But the point is that there are these individuals that interact then with other central bankers, and they mix and match. I mean, they'll go from place to place. The current head of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, used to be a senior partner at Goldman Sachs International. He went on to become the head of the Central Bank of Italy, and now he is the head of the European Central Bank, which basically controls the level and the cost of money and the buyback of QE programs in Europe for all of Europe.
Let's bring in another call now. Let's go to Brian now from Heartland. Hi, Brian.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
So I just kind of have a comment on the whole financial crisis to begin with. I think that something that we're kind of ignoring is that maybe it's kind of evidence that maybe we have more of a plutocracy in America than a democratic system or an elective republic. You see it with the repeal of Citizens United and unlimited campaign finance and special interest money all over the place. And the amount of bankers and Wall Street executives that were actually jailed for destroying the American economy, it was kind of indicative that maybe just money talks, and that's the only thing that's important. It's a plutocracy. It's a government for the wealthy and by the wealthy. So I don't know. That's just kind of, I think, the way that America is going, and I don't exactly know how to change
it. Yeah, Brian, let's pose that to Nomi. What are your thoughts there?
Well, Brian, yeah, if we look at a plutocracy as being just that, a sort of government or sort of rule by the wealthy for the wealthy, it isn't actually even just, although that's also a part of it, the campaign contributions, that's certainly a part. In this quarter, it so happens that these big six banks had record profits. They also saved $3.6 billion collectively in tax savings from what? Jamie Dimon, the chair and CEO of Chase, euphemistically called QE4, which was the recent tax cuts, which just provided more disproportionate free money to the top of that echelon than the bottom. And $3.6 billion just in tax savings allow them to kind of go and lobby and spend a couple more hundred billion, over $100 million, sorry, so a very small fraction of that in terms of lobbying efforts. But it's also these relationships. It's that there is access. So the head, again, of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, was a director, a Class A director at the New York Fed when the crisis happened. So it's not an accident that he was able to maneuver Tim Geithner, who then sort of stepped ultimately into the Treasury Secretary position under President Obama, to enact policies that kind of protect the idea of this plutocracy, that allow a tremendous multi-trillion-dollar global subsidy to be provided to the private banks in the hopes that perhaps they would offer sort of extra perks to customers and sort of real people throughout the world. And they didn't do that. Why didn't they do that? Because they don't have to do that. Because Jamie Dimon, to go back to one of them, was a New York Fed director, and then he became Obama's favorite banker, according to Obama, and then he was picked on the Business Advisory Council for President Trump in the beginning part of his administration. So it's like these people don't have a partisanship, really. They have the ability to sort of influence what monetary policy is and then what fiscal policy is, or where money gets spent in the actual budget of the government. And the thing is, if more debt is created and more debt has to be repaid in the future, then at some point that amount of money is going to have to be associated into the budget. And that means that you have all these ongoing battles in Washington. I'm actually sitting in Washington right now of, what do we cut? Do we cut these teachers to pay for something else or to pay for our debt or whatever it is in terms of budgetary amounts? That trickles down to states. That trickles down to the individuals who are, who are working in these jobs or in these areas. So all of it, yes, it goes into the top with the sort of narrative that it's going to somehow wash down onto the masses. And the reality is, if you miss a credit card payment and your credit card rate's at 12%, it jumps up to 28%. If you tank the financial system, you get trillions of dollars and tax breaks.
So we have a question here. John from Partyville called in to ask, where does all the money the government finds the big banks go? Who gets that money? Where does it end up?
That is a really good question, because it doesn't go one-to-one to the people that were involved in that particular settlement. That's the idea. And there's like multiple entities between the Department of Justice, the Securities Exchange Commission, and whoever might be involved in a particular settlement, depending on the fraud or the crime or the situation. It's supposed to go to help the individuals or anyone who sued with sort of class action and other types of lawsuits that tend to sometimes get rolled into these things. But in fact, some of it goes into sort of tax deductions from the standpoint of these institutions that are supposed to provide this give back. Some goes into sort of the bank of the SEC or different areas in the government. And then some of it goes out to the individuals that were involved. And in the case of the financial crisis, and for example, mortgage-related foreclosures because of fraud committed against individuals, a lot of that didn't get to people at all, or certainly in time for them to save their home. So the process is very slow, even when these settlements sound like, $110 billion, which is a lot of money from the top six banks. The reality is not all of it goes back, and what goes back doesn't go back quickly. And to them, actually, $110 billion over 10 years between the six of them is like nothing.
Let's bring in Justin now from Appleton. Hi, Justin. Go ahead.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that I think it's extremely interesting that it's finally becoming much more widely publicized, going down this rabbit hole of information. And for the past 5 years now, I've been really, really diving deep into rabbit holes similar to this. And every time I try to talk about it with my peers, I don't really have the ability to express and explain everything in depth. And I think it's beautiful that that is what you are doing with this information, and you're bringing it to everyone's minds, and we're going to think about it.
Well, Justin, thanks so much for calling in. And Nomi, I mean, you went all over the world to try to understand the interconnectedness of this all and how central banks work. This is really heavy stuff. This is hard to understand, but there are some basic ideas that happen with central banks that you're really trying to pull out here.
Right. So there's sort of the core central banks or the major ones, and just that would be the Federal Reserve, the Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank, and to a much lesser extent, the Bank of England, who really promoted quantitative easing in their different ways over the years. And sort of collusively, like when the Fed sort of took their foot off the gas pedal of their level of quantitative easing, then the European Central Bank would step up theirs, or the Bank of Japan would step up theirs. If anyone looks at my Twitter right now, I just put up a graph this morning that exactly shows that. It's really simple. There's three lines, and those lines collectively go up and have continued to go up, even though recently the Fed has talked about the health of the economy and they're going to draw back their program and everything else. The reality is these central banks are afraid that they will crash the stock market, and so they're maintaining this sort of artificial stimulation of the market. So when I go around the world, I really saw that in different ways. And the regions that I selected were selected because they examined different ramifications as well as collaborations amongst the different areas. So for example, Mexico, and it would take a long time to go through all the areas, but to give a sense for what was going on, I spent a lot of time in Mexico anyway over the years, and in a lot of central cities and stuff, in terms of speaking and working with universities and different activist groups and different, just financial groups to determine sort of how the middle and sort of bottom level of banking could be more useful for individuals as opposed to, so the upper tiers that get all the perks. And Mexico is interesting because, this goes back to people, going back to the characters in the book. There were two men in Mexico. There's the third one now that runs the central bank. But during the course of the book, there was a man named Guillermo Ortiz who had been active in the government of Mexico during NAFTA, during the 1994 tequila crisis. And that had caused this like major banking crisis in Mexico and so forth. And so he had experience as the central bank head at the time the financial crisis started in how not to and how to provide remedies in the case. And he took a trip up to Washington and had a meeting with Ben Bernanke. It was covered by the Wall Street Journal and others for a minute. And he basically said, look, the most important thing here is not to, sort of just sustain these banks, but to instill confidence on a long-term basis with the people of your country within how they get money and where they put money. Because otherwise, at some point, it's going to create a bigger problem. Trust me, I know this. But the ramifications of that were, first of all, Ben Bernanke kind of ignored him, and second of all, he ignored him to the extent that the man's not even mentioned at all in Ben Bernanke's memoirs. So there were warnings from some sort of peripheral countries to the U.S. They were just ignored, and as a result, also Guillermo Ortiz was not reappointed to be the head of the central bank in Mexico because the president of Mexico decided that it was more important to be close to the United States, even though the crisis had been caused with the United States. Was leaking south of the border, and their economy was dropping precipitously to at least be sort of, compatico. And so then another central bank head, Augustin Carstens, was put in place. Ortiz went on a sort of speaking circuit. He started warning the world about how regulators had failed and this shouldn't happen again and all this kind of stuff. Augustin Carstens, who was considered closer to Wall Street, closer to the Fed, became the central bank head. And he, at first, sort of follow the Fed's policy. They started reducing the cost of money in Mexico as well, not by as much, but sort of tried to do the same thing. But that had the effect of creating major inflation in Mexico and being a real detriment to small businesses and individuals. And ultimately, he quit his post as the head of the central bank. Now he is head of the Bank of International Settlements in Europe, which is the central bank of central banks, and even they are critical of these policies that have happened. And that's a huge swing from a supporter of central banks and the larger ones to being the main critique of it. And so that the process by which individuals sort of came to realizations in their ways outside of the United States is very interesting in Mexico. Right now, Mexico has the highest rates it's had in a long time in order to thwart inflation and basically thwarting the Fed's policy. And then Brazil, which I won't go totally into, but I spent a lot of
To pause right there with Mexico, looking at Mexico, the U.S., going into Brazil, China. We're learning about what central banks have to do with their interconnectedness, how the Fed fits into the global equation. Nomi Prinz is our guide. Her new book is Collusion, How Central Banks Rig the World. You can jump in with your questions, your observations, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick it up in just a moment on the Ideas Network. Author Nomi Prinz concludes that central banks operate in collusion. When the Fed signals it's raising rates or markets overreact negatively to the threat, another central bank steps in. By colluding, other central banks offer even more QE, quantitative easing. We're exploring the interconnectedness of world economies, how dark money works, what it means to us Americans, whether we're in the market or not, and roughly half of Americans don't own stock. Nomi Prinz stays with us as our guide on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Her new book is called Collusion, and your questions about the inner workings of central banks, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go back to the phones now with Mike in Hancock. Hi, Mike.
Well, good morning. I wanted to thank you for challenging all of us listeners with an intricacy of abstractions, which is kind of how I look at finance and especially world finance. I'm a retired school teacher, expert at very little, but it seems to me that a massive crime took place in 2008. It was so big and so many billions of trillions of dollars lost that, you know, it was mind-boggling. I know it had something to do with credit default swaps or something like that. But there was a crime committed, trillions lost. I don't know where that money went, but I know that the people on Wall Street, the bankers, did not seem to suffer. In fact, they seem to prosper. All I learned from the Nixon thing was to follow the money, and the money seems to wind up with the Wall Street bankers and the international bankers. There's a smell of corruption, and that's what I'm seeing. I'd like to know if I'm off base on that, and I would like to know what, in a practical sense, the average guy can do about it.
Great question there, Mike. Nomi.
Thanks, Mike. Yes, it's a great question and observations. Yes, that money and following the money is a really good way to see that not only did these banks commit and continue to commit crimes against their customers, on regular people and on the world by extension, but that they were rewarded for doing so, that they effectively got really free money. When money is rendered to 0% interest for banks, it's free. And when money is rendered at 0% interest to banks, individual savers or retirees don't get the same return or interest on their savings accounts or in pensions that used to be calibrated to the level of treasury rates or government bonds or some more secure level of interest, which is now close to zero as well. So people have not benefited from this policy of shifting trillions of dollars to the top of the financial system to banks that committed all of these crimes. And in different countries, this manifests in different ways. In Europe, it manifested in such a way that the European Central Bank still provides money to the main corporations of the area, which tend to be in the countries with stronger economies, and it doesn't provide that assistance to areas in the weaker economies throughout the European Union. So these central banks, you know, they conjured money. It wasn't from their own pockets. It wasn't made. It wasn't toiled for. It was just basically electronically fabricated, went to the top, and it did wash over a lot of crime, and it continues to wash over a lot of crime. And what's really sad is that today, and this is not really different from how the Fed operates over the last decade, or even before that, but just accelerated the last decade big time, is that the head of the central bank believes that the banks are healthy and that everything is fine and wants to push a policy of deregulating or loosening restrictions of what banks can do with their money in terms of following that money, even more so than we are now. And it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, if you give a whole pile of money to a group of miscreants and they use it and then they go back to the well for more and it's available and they have less and less rules, well, of course, when they don't behave, ultimately it's going to cause a crisis for the rest of the world.
Well, Nomi Prinz, what is the fix then, and what can people do, as Mike asks?
So individuals can, for example, try to find their way into working with banks that aren't part of this system because, you know, it's the big banks that get the most benefits. If you start looking at community banks or local banks or potentially having public banks or national banks, then we have a situation where people are working with how banks kind of used to work with citizens, you know, which is sort of a brick and mortar approach. I'm a small business. Take an example. There's a bar in my town in California and in Ohio, and you know there's a small business there, and people come and you know they have drinks and or people come and they buy things outside the bar beforehand or they go on afterwards and do something else, and there's this whole sort of idea that a small business can manifest in a lot of economic well-being, and it's also a social area, and it's a small town, so people get together and share ideas and create things in that space and everything else. There's a positivity to that. And having some form of direct lending from a local bank is a way to sort of provide that. So when there is a crisis, we had a fire in that area of California, there's an ability to talk to real people and say, look, I'm not going to make as much money this month because nobody's in town and nobody can really breathe the air. That's the kind of thing. And you will also find that you'll get better rates at some of the smaller banks because they're not trying to take all of your money out and use it in major speculative ways. They're not using it to buy their stock in these multi-billion dollar packages that the big banks are. So it stays in the community. We build from the foundation upward rather than, you know, try to believe the narrative that it's going to somehow trickle down.
Okay, so think local, act local, but is there any way to dial back the role of central banks, or do we need to accept and acknowledge their power is ongoing?
Yeah, their power is at the moment ongoing, and it's increased substantially since this crisis, and they don't have another plan to, for example, divert the money that they've provided to these institutions to other more useful real economic endeavors, infrastructure development, helping wages, forgiving student debt, literally anything. And I think this has to be, the Federal Reserve was created by an act of Congress in 1913. My last book sort of deals with all of that, all the president's bankers and the history. But the reality is an act of Congress or amendments to that act that was passed by Congress could require the Federal Reserve to siphon off part of what they do or limit what they can do for the private banking system on the philosophy that if they can provide money so unilaterally, it should be provided on a less subsidizing the banks and taking it from the population type of way, and it needs to be redistributed, and there needs to be limitations. In addition, banks need to be broken up a la Glass-Steagall in order to avoid, when the next crisis happens, a situation where there's more requests from the Fed and more of this happens and there's more sort of bailout concoctions because our deposits and our loans remain intermingled and as chips on that betting table for all the other sorts of nefarious things banks, the larger banks will do with it.
Well, Nomi, we really appreciate the conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Nomi Prinz is an author and a media commentator. She was previously managing editor at Goldman Sachs on Wall Street and ran the International Analytics Group as a senior managing director at Bear Stearns in London. She writes for magazines. She's the author of 6 books. Her latest out this week is called Collusion: How Central Bankers Rigged the World. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina and Colleen Leahy. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation about central banks, you find it on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for listening.